This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker in Woods Hole. It's Friday, June 11th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Sam Houghton. We'll speak with Brian Dowd of the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent. We'll hear from Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, and we'll check in with CAI's Daniel Ackerman and Eve Zuckoff. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the Coast, and the Islands. We are joined by CAI lead reporter Jeanette Barnes. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
Jeanette, it's now been more than a week since the Steamship Authority was hit by ransomware, and the website functionality still hasn't come back online. But the authority has been posting periodic updates and trying to make using the ferry as normal as possible for riders. What's the latest on this?
Well, now you can make reservations by phone at the regular reservation phone number in Mashpee. You still cannot make reservations online. And as you say, the ferry's main website has a static message from the Steamship Authority with kind of the latest update of the day. But many days, the update is similar to the previous day, depending on what kinds of things they've been able to change. Right now, they're only taking reservations for travel that starts within a 7-day window. So if part of your trip occurs within 7 days, then you can make the reservation now. If not, you have to wait. As far as tickets, you buy tickets at the terminals, but reservations at those ticket counters are now only allowed for what's called Islander preferred spaces on the ferry. Those are for island residents. You can be either year-round or seasonal. And they're also allowed for trips to medical appointments. The Steamship Authority is posting those updates on social media. They're answering riders' questions on social media as well. There are definitely some people posting on there who are concerned because they can't make a vehicle reservation for midsummer. And, you know, they don't know if they show up, what's going to happen. But as far as schedules, the Steamship Authority does have that alternative kind of temporary website they set up that displays all the schedules and fares in an easy to read way. That's steamshipauthorityschedules.com. It's different than their regular web address.
You spoke this week with an information technology professor about ransomware prevention and also about how to cope with an attack if it does happen. What did you learn?
Yes. I talked with Louis Biko of Cape Cod Community College, and he said coping with a ransomware attack is a little like doing disaster recovery, and many organizations are not prepared for that kind of disaster. He says they need to have a plan for how they will operate or run their business if their systems are shut down. So one way to do that, he said, is to have redundancies built in, which means things like a second server. So if one is compromised, you could switch over to the backup. In terms of prevention, he did mention some of the common ones and some not as commonly done. So strong passwords, most folks are aware, are still important, and training employees to recognize phishing attacks as well. But he said most organizations don't do on an annual basis what's known as a pen test or penetration test. And that's when a hacker with company authorization tests the system by trying to break in. And that exposes vulnerabilities that need to be fixed.
The Steamship Authority was in the news for a separate incident on Monday, an alleged sexual assault of a woman on the ferry traveling from Martha's Vineyard to Woods Hole. Information on this case has been pretty limited so far. What do we know?
Well, the Cape and Islands District Attorney's Office tells me the alleged incident happened inside the delivery truck on the ferry. The state police say the alleged victim is 18 years old, and she reported a sexual assault to Falmouth police once the ferry docked in Woods Hole. The suspect is Bruno Sanchez de Jesus, who's 20, lives in Dorchester. He had left the ferry as a passenger in a commercial box truck after they docked. A state trooper out of Bourne stopped the truck heading north on 28, and that's where the man was arrested. He's been charged with 2 counts of rape, and the wording of those charges includes the use of force.
He was arraigned Tuesday in Falmouth District Court. What happened there?
The judge set bail at $25,000. I checked with the court clerk's office this morning, and he has not posted bail. If he does, he'll have GPS monitoring and a no contact order to stay away from the woman in this case. In the meantime, he is being held at the Barnstable County House of Correction, and he does have a court date. His next court date is for a probable cause hearing, and that's on June 29th.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here, Steve.
An unusual wildlife incident reported yesterday in Hyannis involving rabies. CAI's Morning Edition producer and reporter Sam Houghton joins us with this story and more. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
Sam, what do we know about this rabies incident?
Yeah, so this is the first recorded case of rabies in almost a decade. Barnstable Animal Control, they got a report of a sick-looking raccoon in Hyannis. They did some testing to find out that it did, in fact, have rabies that came back this week. The raccoon was euthanized. Barnstable County say there was no human contact with the raccoon, which is important. Rabies is lethal. There was a Cape man that did die back in 2013 after he was bitten by a bat. So in response, this regional group, it's represented with folks from Barnstable County and the South Coast, they're hoping to vaccinate several hundred raccoons on the Cape. They actually put out these bait traps that have the rabies vaccine in it. They've already put out thousands of these on the Upper Cape, and they're looking to expand that to the rest of the Cape. Also, following this recent, you know, incident, they're sending out reminders to residents to get their pets vaccinated against rabies. You know, dogs and cats and ferrets actually are required to get vaccinated. And of course, they're saying, you know, stay away from wild and stray animals.
Let's talk about town meetings, Sam, more town meetings this weekend. And we will be talking about them throughout the program, but you've got a preview of a couple of these. Let's start in East Ham. What are voters looking at in East Ham?
Yeah, it seems like the most contentious here will be a proposal to buy a plaza on Route 6. It's kind of a 3-acre kind of strip mall that currently has a Nauset ice cream store, a liquor store, and like a Thai food restaurant. The idea here is to make it more walkable, kind of a pedestrian-friendly area that could, you know, potentially prevent some larger developments in the future that residents might not like. The town is asking for about $3 million to purchase the property. Some of that funding would be for repairs and kind of general maintenance of the area. Also kind of interesting on the warrant, the town hopes to increase a local tax on short-term rentals like Airbnbs. Mm-hmm. East Ham currently charges 4%, but they want to boost that to 6%. That's actually the maximum allowed by the state. A lot of towns really on the Cape have already boosted that up to 6%. Funding could go to things like affordable housing. And actually some of that tax would go to this plaza if the town meeting does approve that purchase. And kind of also interesting on the warrant, there's an article to help out shell fishermen. The idea is to, you know, give growers the ability to drive out on tidal flats in order to reach their farms.
Tisbury town meeting happening this weekend or meetings. This is a complicated setup. Depending on how you count, there might be, I think, 3 town meetings this weekend in Tisbury. Explain what's happening here.
Yeah, I think it's easier to think about this as 2 town meetings, Saturday and Sunday. There will be an annual and a special town meeting on Saturday. You know, I think it's some of those old New England rules at play here. But the big one is on Sunday. It's a single article warrant for the town to finally move forward with the renovation of the Tisbury School in addition. The school is over 90 years old. A townwide vote was rejected a few years ago, but then chipping lead paint was found in the school, and that's kind of really underscored the need for this. The parents, teachers organization, I actually heard from them this morning. They say it's really, you know, it's time for voters to go forward with this. Mm. It is $55 million, and the state won't be pitching in to help. Tisbury, you know, lost out on that opportunity when they rejected the school rebuild in 2018. So we'll see how that turns out on Sunday. And then Saturday, we should mention they could come up with some very strong climate goals. Many towns on the Vineyard have already adopted similar things, but this is kind of a pledge to be fossil fuel free by 2040. So interesting weekend ahead for Tisbury.
Some news in Barnstable this week as we learned that the school superintendent, Meg Mayo Brown, will be leaving the district when her contract expires next year. This is the Cape's biggest district, and she's navigated it through the pandemic, and it hasn't always been easy. Tell us what we know about her stepping down.
So the school committee was going to discuss her contract extension at a recent meeting, but before they could, she made her announcement. She will stay on for the next school year. So this actually started about a year ago. The board decided that they wouldn't extend her contract, but then later decided they would revisit the extension kind of in a year's time, which came up this June. So Mayo Brown, she didn't give any reasons for leaving the district, at least at this meeting. She did say that it's good timing. She can, you know, navigate the school through the rest of the pandemic, the schools, and give a new administration kind of a fresh start. We should say, though, there was some tension within the community at the beginning of the year. The high school principal was put on leave, but, mm-hmm. but there never was much explanation, at least publicly, over those reasons. Patrick Clark ended up stepping down as the principal. Some town elected officials were publicly pretty upset with that, and there was some protests or rallies in front of the high school. But then you had her, you know, she had her supporters, some on the school committee. She said she was great for the district. So ultimately, you know, Barnstable is looking for a new superintendent, and they have a year to do it.
That is CAI's Sam Houghton. Sam, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on the Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll be speaking with Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on the Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. On Martha's Vineyard, the Vineyard Trust is a nonprofit responsible for a number of historic properties across the island. This week, some big news as the president and CEO abruptly resigned. Brian Dowd of the Martha's Vineyard Times has the story for us. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Steve.
Brian, this comes after reports of impropriety around grant applications by the trust. What's the latest here?
Sure. So Funi Burdick, who's the Vineyard Trust's president and CEO, resigned this week after issues with two grant applications. They were altered. They were grant applications for Community Preservation Committee funding, which is a certain set of funding that the towns get and they can use for historic projects, several things. And these grant applications were for two of the trust's pretty famous properties, the Old Whaling Church in Edgartown and Flying Horses Carousel in Oak Bluffs. What happened was last Friday, it came to light that at a CPC committee meeting in Edgartown, Town Administrator James Haggerty confirmed that there was a construction quote for work to be done on the Whaling Church that had been altered from what was originally sent to the trust. So basically what happened was there was a contractor who submitted a quote to the trust saying, I will charge so-and-so amount for painting work and construction work on the Old Whaling Church. And somewhere along the line, that quote was altered and a different quote was sent to the Edgartown CPC committee. When this altered quote was sent, that ended up in the hands of the town, and the town became concerned with that.
And one of the things here is that altered quote that was sent along was still sent under the original letterhead, right? As if it had come from the contractor, but the numbers and some of the description of the work had been changed along the way, and so that the contractor's work was misrepresented.
Correct. So there was basically three copies of this quote. There was the original that the contractor had sent to the trust. There was a penned-in version where someone had clearly gone in with a pen, scratched out figures and estimates, and put in new ones, higher ones. And then there was the third one that, and they're all under the, yeah, correct, under the same letterhead of this contractor, and that one was submitted to the town. So when it became, when this became evident to the town, they took immediate action. And this is concerning because the funding request has to be approved at annual town meeting, which was last month. And this came to light about 24 hours before town meeting. So at town meeting, the select board and the town administrator pulled the funding article from the town warrant, and then came out publicly with what the issue was.
What kind of fallout are you seeing now? We heard that the president and CEO has stepped down. She resigned. What else is happening?
Sure. So this week, after the news came out, Burdick resigned, and the board of trustees is came out with a statement saying, you know, this happened, and not only at the Wailing Church, but there were other issues with the Flying Horses Carousel in Oak Bluffs, and we're still trying to gather information on exactly what happened there, but it seems that it was something similar, and relating to the same issues with requesting CPC funding. So now the trust has put in a new interim director, or president, Sally Rohrer, who's a board member, as they begin to search for a new one.
And they're doing some work to try to make sure something like this doesn't happen. I mean, so much of what they do depends on transparency.
Sure. Yeah, this is obviously a very front-facing nonprofit on the island. You know, they got properties all over the place. So now they're going to have they have a governance committee on their board, and that's chaired by Robin Graham, and they're working on establishing some what they called strict protocol to ensure errors like this aren't repeated. They didn't go too much into that in their statement that they sent out to the public, but you know, they want the public to know that they're taking the stewardship of these 20-something historic properties pretty seriously, and that, you know, something like this, they're going to make sure to the best of their ability that it won't happen again.
It's Brian Dowd of the Martha's Vineyard Times. And at the Times website, you can actually click on a link and see all three versions of that grant request, mm-hmm. the original, the altered, hand-altered copy, and the final. Brian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
Chatham has a town meeting this weekend, and that's not all that's happening in town. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle is here to catch us up. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, let's start with town meeting. Briefly, what's big on the warrant?
Yeah, the big items on the warrant are a vote on an $8.3 million senior center proposed for property in West Chatham. This was postponed from last year when town meetings were scaled back. And it's not without controversy. There's also a dueling proposal to put a senior center off Stepping Stones Road on school property, but that's a petition article that doesn't have the backing of town officials or the school department, which the West Chatham article is backed by town officials. The other major set of articles that we're going to be dealing with tomorrow are more than a half dozen measures that deal with affordable housing and related issues. Included is the acquisition of a couple of acres of land in West Chatham for housing, and designation of land off of Middle Road, town-owned land off of Middle Road, for purposes of housing. That's also recently become a bit controversial with folks not wanting to give up the wooded land that property currently represents. There will also be a vote on the proposed mansion tax, which we've talked about before, which is a one half of 1% surcharge on property sales over $2 million, and also a proposal to file a special legislation for a couple of other proposals to help raise money for both attainable and affordable housing. Town meeting begins tomorrow in Chatham here at noon at Veterans Field. Hopefully the weather will hold out and we'll have a good day for it.
We have about 2 minutes here. I want to talk about another story you have this week. This is about a French adventurer with a unique plan for getting back across the Atlantic. Tell us about this fella.
Sure. His name is Jirek Soudé. He is, as you said, an adventurer from France. He sailed around the world, and he recently completed, over the winter, rowing across the Atlantic from the Canary Islands to the Caribbean, that sort of east to west crossing, which is a lot easier than the crossing west to east, which he says he's going to attempt sometime soon. He's going to be leaving from Chatham in a 26-foot wooden-hulled rowboat called a Romaine, and his plan is to row from Chatham to his home in Brittany on the coast of France. He was inspired during his recent row across the Caribbean to the Caribbean by reading a book by Gerard Doubleville, who was another French rower who rowed from Chatham to Brittany in 1980 in 72 days. This can be a pretty treacherous crossing because the later in the season that a rower leaves, while it gives him a better, more favorable winds and currents, he's also more likely to run into some severe weather and hurricanes. A number of rowers have made this attempted to make this crossing. Several have made it. At least one has lost his life doing it. Mm. So it's a pretty challenging thing for someone to do. And Jirek is right now sort of looking for the best window to leave, and he hopes to leave soon. He'll be tracking his journey on his social media accounts and his website, and you know, we'll have weekly updates in the Chronicle once he pushes off from Chatham, hopefully within the next couple of weeks.
And that's Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. It's quite a story. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Steve. Take care.
To mask or not to mask, that is the question across the Cape and across much of the country. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent has the take from Provincetown. Hi, Ed.
Hello there, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Okay. Ed, it's a peculiar moment, particularly for local businesses. Your reporter, Paul Sullivan, took a walk down Commercial Street. Tell us what he found.
Well, yes, it's a very odd moment. And anybody who's been to Provincetown in the last week or two knows that it's gotten extremely busy. It's not quite as treacherous as rowing across the Atlantic, but walking down Commercial Street is an experience. It's obvious that a lot of people are not wearing masks now, and not even carrying masks with them. Of course, the rules now are that you don't have to wear a mask. For a long time, Commercial Street was a mandatory mask zone outdoors for everyone. The rules now are suspended. But individual store owners are allowed to make their own rules about whether masks are required or simply recommended or preferred, and there's a wide range along the street.
It's difficult for in a sense, the store owners are the people policing this and asking folks who are coming along to either mask or not to mask as they come into the stores, and that puts them in a strange position.
It does. It puts them in a very odd position. And for example, Paul wrote about Kohi Coffee Company, which is in a very tight space on Commercial Street towards the West End. And they previously required masks, as all businesses do. Then they changed to having a big sign that looks like a stop sign, but what it says is that masks are preferred. And the manager of the store, Diana Galligan, said that she really had a hard time figuring out what to do. She says the rest of the staff and I would feel more comfortable if customers wore masks, but I'm not in a position to turn customers away. And she says that even with the preferred sign on the door, only about 10% of the people who come in are wearing a mask. She says, you know, people are really confused. They've been told that if they're vaccinated, they don't have to wear a mask, so they're not thinking about it anymore. But the store managers are thinking about themselves and their staff, you know, their staff people who are exposed to hundreds of people every day. Mm-hmm. And they can, if they choose, require, you know, like people to show a vaccination card. But hardly anyone is doing that. The Boat Slip Resort, which has the famous tea dance every night, they are requiring not just photo ID, but also proof of vaccination. But no one else that we know of, at least, is requiring that.
It is an interesting point that if you're going into a store, you're just there for 5 minutes, maybe. But the folks who work there are seeing hundreds of people all day long, and that's why they may ask you to wear a mask inside.
Yes, and one of the stores on Bradford Street, the Farland Provisions, is one of the places that does require masks. And part of the reason is that the only known death from COVID-19 in Provincetown was John Perrone, who was an employee of Farland Provisions. And so the owners have his life very much on their minds, and they are requiring masks there, as is the East End Market, the other grocery and sandwich shop on Bradford Street.
That is Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent joining us. Ed, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Good to be with you, Steve.
Nantucket Town Meeting defeated an article to bring more regulations to short-term rentals. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror has this one. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, this was a long town meeting. Is it the single longest meeting in memory there?
It's certainly the single longest one-day meeting. Nantucket has had Saturday town meetings off and on, depending on the spring holiday schedule. Normally, obviously, our town meetings are in the beginning of April, but COVID has messed things up a little bit as far as that goes. So depending on the Easter and Passover holidays, we've had a few Saturday town meetings over the last few years, and they've lasted anywhere from 6 to 8 hours. This one wrapped up in just under 9 hours. So it's quite possibly the longest single day meeting. We've had three or four night town meetings in the past that might have exceeded that, but only in 2-3-plus-hour chunks. So it was definitely a long day, but it was outside under a tent. The weather cooperated. Everybody seemed to be in accommodating moods, and a lot of business was taken care of, including, as you mentioned, the short-term rental discussion. Voters overwhelmingly rejected that proposal, along with a move to earmark a quarter of the land bank's annual revenue for affordable housing initiatives. They did also, however, approve more than $16 million in spending and borrowing for affordable housing, partially through debt exclusion overrides that must still be approved at the annual town election, which is coming up on Tuesday. They also approved a ban on the commercial use of gas-powered leaf blowers, restrictions on the size and number of traffic signs, and a prohibition on pools on lots under 7,500 square feet in a number of zoning districts, particularly just outside the downtown. A proposal to reestablish a park and recreation department and hire its director was also approved. But the big story of the day, obviously, was short-term rentals and, to a lesser degree, the land bank article. And an amendment by ACT Now, the political action group that proposed the short-term rental article to exempt year-round property owners from the regulations, didn't resonate with the voters. It was, again, overwhelmingly defeated, 625-297. It would have established a local rental registry and set strict limits on the number of days a home could be rented each year, require minimum stays, and restrict the number of people per bedrooms and vehicles per rentals. It's been very strongly debated over the last 6 months or so, with supporters arguing that investor-driven short-term rentals in particular are reducing the town's limited amount of year-round housing and negatively impacting quality of life out here, while opponents say the majority of short-term rentals are not owned by investment companies, but either year-round residents or off-islanders who rely on that income to pay their mortgages and pay the bills, and that restricting short-term rentals would have a significant impact on the hospitality industry, which is obviously the primary driver of the island's economy out here.
But Act Now, this group who put that forward, they say they're going to continue with this effort.
They are. They say they're going to attempt to bring it back in some way, shape, or form. They can't bring back the same proposal because it was rejected. Nantucket Town Meeting rules say you'd have to wait 3 years to do that, but there are potentially any other number of ways that they could get another bite at the apple and attempt to restrict short-term rentals. State law does allow municipalities a number of different options for regulating short-term rentals across the state.
Let me ask you about another story in the paper this week that this has to do with the island's shortage of primary care physicians. It's getting worse, but there are some plans to try to remedy the situation.
There are, and as many things go on Nantucket, the problem revolves around housing. We lost a primary care physician this week. Dr. Joel Haas decided to leave for personal reasons, and he is the third primary care physician since 2019 to leave the island, which means there's only four now working through Nantucket Cottage Hospital. And housing is the issue. Dr. Tim Lempery, who's the island's longest-serving primary care physician, said there's just doctors don't want to come out here because they can't find housing, or the housing they can find is not necessarily what they'd be able to live in on the mainland. And the hospital does say, though, that they have some money left over from the Capitol Building campaign for the new facility that they just completed about a year or so ago. And they're looking to build staff housing across the street from the hospital on a property they own over there. So that is the way they're looking at it right now, but at the moment there is a shortage of primary care physicians, and if you don't have one right now, you're looking at about a 60-day wait to get an appointment.
Mm. Which is longer than it would be in most other places.
It is, and they're hoping, by bringing in some summer staff and making some changes that they can get down to 30 days. Obviously, if you have a medical emergency, you can still go to the emergency department. That hasn't changed. But again, primary care, checkups, those kind of things are taking quite a while if you don't already have a primary care physician that you can get into.
That's Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer. And Mayor Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker, broadcasting from Woods Hole. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Managing wastewater is a problem across the region. It is particularly acute on Martha's Vineyard. Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette has the story and joins us now. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Noah, those buried septic trucks, which we heard about last week on the program, have come to light. These trucks were entirely buried. Is that right? And this week they were excavated. Let's start the story here. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so these were two massive tankers. They were the back portion of septic tanker trucks. They were each about 8,000 to 9,000 gallons, and they were buried on a property that a septic hauling company was renting. of course, burying septic storage tanks is illegal under state Title V law. Septic storage needs to be done above ground in a temporary holding tank with wheels. This, of course, was below ground, although it still had wheels. And so the Fishery Board of Health had ordered them to be removed, and the state DEP and the Board of Health were present for the removal on Monday, and it was quite a sight to behold.
So the hauler here thought that by burying the tanks, they could be in ground, but because they still were on wheels. But, of course, that doesn't pass right. The muster. But really, this is part of a bigger story about a wastewater issue, what to do with septic haulage on the island. And there's really nowhere for this to go.
Right. That is kind of the bigger issue here. And it's a really interesting and fascinating one with a lot of sort of chemicals in many places. But the reason they were buried, as you said, was that septic waste now is going to need to be stored by the haulers on the island before they truck it off island to dispose of it. And this is sort of an issue that became acute at the start of the pandemic when the Edgartown Wastewater Facility, which is by far the largest on the island, they started curtailing the amount of septic that they were accepting. It was partially a result of the pandemic. Septic waste is really concentrated compared to sewer flow. And the treatment plants aren't supposed to accept a large percentage of it relative to the amount of flow they're getting. Of course, during the pandemic, flow really decreased. And so the sort of issues that the plant was facing became more acute. But what happened was they did a study about the plant capacity in Edgartown in the study showed that the plant was reaching capacity anyway. And so the policy as it stands right now is to only accept a small amount of Edgartown-only septic waste, and then the rest for the haulers on the island has to be trucked off, and that sort of created a bunch of issues for them, logistical and economic.
So one of the big issues is that the haulers have to, if they're trucking this off, they can't obviously just go do a pump out and drive onto the ferry,
right,
and take it away. They have to hold it somewhere.
Exactly. So they have to hold it somewhere, and, you know, one of them was holding it underground. but, you know, it's sort of symptomatic of the bigger issue here, not to excuse it at all. But there are septic haulers who are doing this legally. It's just expensive and challenging, and you need to get a special permit to be able to build a temporary frac tank. You need to have the space and the money to do it. Right now, there's only two septic hauling companies that have the ability to store the waste before trucking it off island. One of them is Jay's Septic Services. And what they're doing, actually, we talked to Jay this week, and he was saying that they're actually doing a trip off island every day from May until October. You know, it's causing prices to go up. It's more difficult to get a septic pump out appointment, which potentially could mean that people are deferring maintenance on their tanks, which, of course, is an environmental issue that the boards of health don't want to deal with. So it really is just sort of a it's a tangled web of problems, really, but kind of an interesting one and difficult to deal with on the island.
Yeah, and there's no real plan to increase capacity on the island, which would be a huge,
right,
expensive undertaking to build a bigger waste treatment facility or expand
completely.
One.
Edgartown, a while back, had to increase the capacity of the facility, and it costs, you know, in the tens of millions of dollars to do something like that. So I think for Edgartown officials, you know, they're concerned and want to make sure that the facility that they do have lasts. And one of the ways to do that is to ensure that you're not getting too high a percentage of septic coming into it relative to the flow that you have. And the other issue with that, too, is that I think talking to the wastewater facility manager, 98% of the nitrogen gets, you know, they're able to filter out 98% of it. But 2% still ends up leaching out of the facility, and that is, you know, part of a plume that heads toward the Edgartown Great Pond. And so when Edgartown was accepting all the island septic pump out, you know, they were a net importer of nitrogen into what is already an impaired watershed. And that's a huge issue on the island, especially with a lot of fragile ecosystems in the Great Ponds. So, you know, the issues sort of stem from pure environmental ones to these economic and logistical ones with trying to get rid of the waste.
That is Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
A new news outlet has started up on the South Coast. With us now to talk about it, CAI's new South Coast reporter, Daniel Ackerman. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, Steve.
Dan, it's great to have you on the show and in the newsroom. Tell us about this new news source on the South Coast. It's called the New Bedford Light.
Yeah, so this is an online news outlet just launched this week. And I talked to their founding editor, Barbara Rossner, and she said the New Bedford Light is really going to specialize in in-depth investigative stories. And so the idea here is to fill the gap as local newspapers have kind of lost their teeth to some degree in recent years. You know, we've seen declining revenues and shrinking staff. And that means a lot of traditional newspapers can't always dig in on these investigative type stories that might take months to report. So Rossner told me that the New Bedford Light is hoping to step in and do that kind of work in New Bedford. The first batch of their stories is on their website now, and they're taking a hard look at the unequal toll that the pandemic has had across New Bedford's communities.
The New Bedford Light's also going to focus on arts and culture too, isn't that right?
Yeah, so Rossner told me that they want to be a hub for New Bedford's diverse art scene. You know, I think one of the things that we've learned in the last year is that the internet can actually be a really useful venue for artists, especially up-and-coming artists who want to reach a wider audience than they might be able to through just, you know, a local gallery show. So the New Bedford Light is going to put together a virtual gallery for visual and performing artists, and that will, they'll kind of pair that arts and culture coverage with the in-depth investigative stuff. So overall, New Bedford Light has a really ambitious mission here, but I think it could be a pretty positive sign for the health of local journalism in the city.
Daniel, you also reported this week on a potential commuter rail service to Cape Cod. Tell us, what did you learn here?
Right. So the State Department of Transportation is looking at possible plans for a weekday train service that would run between the Cape and Boston. So right now, you might know the only rail service to the Cape is the Cape Flyer, but that's pretty limited. It only runs on summer weekends, and so it's not too useful for your typical daily commuter. So this past Wednesday at a public meeting, MassDOT Regional Planning Coordinator Benjamin Muller shared details of what a potential weekday commuter service might look like. So this would share the same tracks as the Cape Flyer. That means on its way from the Cape to Boston, it would pass through Middleborough. And Muller also said that the commuter service could clear up some traffic on state roadways. He said their study showed it might eliminate about 1,000 car trips each day on state roads. And it could also reduce vehicle emissions by about 5,000 tons of CO2 per year.
That's a lot. One of the questions still out there is where exactly the commuter service would stop. Is that right?
Yeah, so it is important to emphasize that this commuter service is not a sure thing just yet. The state is really still in the study phase here. So the southern terminal of the service might either be at Buzzards Bay, just north of Cape Cod Canal, or across the water at Bourne Station. So crossing the water would probably give more Cape residents easier access to the train, but it would also be more expensive to get that service up and running since a number of upgrades to the tracks and signaling systems would be required to make that crossing. So overall, depending on which side of the bridge the train ultimately stops, service to Boston would take about an hour and a half to an hour 40 minutes. And this commuter service, still a few years away. Steve, you can't hop the morning train to Boston just yet, but we'll continue to follow the story since I know a lot of Cape commuters are eager to see what happens here.
Hey, another story you reported on this week. At Brayton Point in Somerset, there was an EPA settlement with the operator of the port. What was going on here?
Right. So the Brayton Point Commerce Center, that's this port on Mount Hope Bay in Somerset, and listeners might remember it as the site of the old coal fire power plant down there that was demolished a couple of years ago. And local officials are hoping the site will be redeveloped to service the offshore wind industry. Now, in the meantime, the port is getting a few other uses. So it's a site where scrap metal is getting collected and loaded onto ships by this company called Patriot Stevedoring and Logistics. And the EPA, in an investigation, found that the company was actually dropping a good deal of scrap metal directly into Mount Hope Bay. So the company was using this mechanical claw to load scrap metal onto the ship. You know, you can kind of imagine it as a giant version of what you might see at a claw machine in an arcade. And anyone who's played those games knows it's easy to drop stuff. So a lot of scrap metal was being dropped into the bay. And the EPA reached a settlement with Patriot Stevedoring and Logistics and fined the company $27,000.
And what happens next down there? There's been some issues with the community as well.
Right. So there could be some more legal action here. Neighbors of the port who I spoke to say that this EPA settlement doesn't go far enough. They basically told me they viewed $27,000 as just a slap on the wrist for this company. I spoke with Kathy Souza, who lives just a few blocks from the port. And she says that even though the company doesn't use that mechanical claw to load ships anymore, it's still quite a nuisance in the neighborhood. She says that metal dust blows off the site and into the neighborhood, which can make it hard to walk outside sometimes. And she also described the sound as metal thunder, which she says she can hear day and night from her house. So Souza heads a citizens group called Save Our Bay Brayton Point. And that group is in the process of collecting video and photos from the operation. You know, that includes photos on people's cell phones and even by drone. And they're hoping to document what they say are a number of legal violations and how the company is continuing to operate. And, you know, the last piece here is that last month, the state attorney general, Maura Healey, announced a 60-day notice of intent to sue Patriot Stevedoring and Logistics, as well as some affiliated companies. And that suit would potentially be looking at violations of the Clean Water Act and Clean Air Act. So For now, local residents are still kind of fed up, still collecting evidence of potential violations, and we'll see what happens with this potential attorney general suit.
And you reached out to the company themselves, and they didn't have any comment on this.
Right. I reached out a few times to them, and they've not gotten back to me. So hoping to reach them, you know, soon and get their take on things. But so far, nothing.
CAI's Daniel Ackerman, our new South Coast reporter, looking forward to plenty more to come. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you, Steve.
The Cape Cod business community has joined the conversation over a proposed machine gun range on Joint Base Cape Cod. CAI's environment reporter talks with us now about this interesting turn of events. Hi, Eve Zuckoff
is
with
us.
Somehow your introduction got lost in the middle of that. Eve Zuckoff, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Why is the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce now speaking out against the proposed machine gun range? Tell us.
Well, it started with an email sent by Brigadier General Foe, who threatened to order thousands of soldiers scheduled to visit the base every weekend this summer to not patronize local restaurants or other businesses. He complained that, quote, the only folks that speak up on the machine gun range project, are naysayers, activists, and anti-military groups. And given the machine gun range or the guards' impact on local businesses, it's hard to believe. You know, he says that they have not heard any support from the business community. He says soldiers are now encouraged to shop on the other side of the bridge. And Wendy Northcross, CEO of the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce, which represents about 1,300 businesses across Cape Cod, wrote a very strongly worded letter back saying she was shocked that the group was being threatened. That's how she interpreted it, especially after the year small businesses have had with COVID shutdowns. And she even went one step further, saying, in fact, the chamber, as an organization, didn't feel like there'd been enough of a public process. That's been a very common criticism of the project. And because of that, the organization now wants to see a, quote, science-based independent review of the environmental impacts of this machine gun range project. And so while it's unclear what the intent of Foe's email was exactly, it was not this.
So there's so much, there's at least a couple of things in this letter that I think it stopped a lot of people in their tracks. And one of them is, as you said, this reference to people who spoke up with concerns about the proposed range as being naysayers and sort of a description of them which seemed to write them off as any opinion they had was going to be considered negligible by the guard. And the other thing is encouraging their employees not to shop on Cape Cod, or encouraging military personnel not to shop on Cape Cod in order to sort of retaliate for what they saw as a lack of support. Both of those things, I think, made people really concerned. It sounds like the chamber too. So in the days since this exchange, tell us what's been happening.
Well, the guard has been pretty quiet, though in the Cape Cod Times, they rejected General Foe's statement saying his comments were, quote, not authorized. And in the Boston Globe, General Foe called a reporter back to say he, quote, probably should have read the letter more closely. Now, though, we've heard General Foe and the guard are trying to form a new subcommittee. This has been kind of in the works, so it doesn't seem like it's exactly a new effort. They think it will somehow improve the public process, but there are very few details at this point on what that would look like, how the committee would be selected, what it would do. So we're kind of hoping to hear more soon on that.
And just a few seconds here, Eve, what's the next step for this whole process with machine gun range? Is another public hearing coming up?
Yes. So a community advisory council meeting is scheduled for tentatively June 17th, though that big asterisks on the tentatively, that could change. And then a final vote on this will be taken by the state's Environmental Management Commission on July 12th. And both of those meetings are public with opportunities to comment.
That is CAI's environment reporter, Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
And that is our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Sam Houghton, George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard, or rather Brian Dowd from the Martha's Vineyard Times. We talked to Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and we heard from Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette and CAI's Daniel Ackerman and Eve Zuckoff there. Big thanks to Dan Tridle, engineering the program back at the studio in Woods Hole. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.